1590 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay,
and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Andy Field. The candidate Republicans nominated as their next speaker is throwing in the towel. Representative Steve Scalise telling a Republican caucus meeting he no longer wants the job. Scalise failed to gather enough Republican support to win election in the full House. No word on what Republicans plan to do next. Secretary of State Antony Blinken in Jordan's capital Amman answering questions about Iran in connection with the Israeli-Hamas war.
We haven't seen direct evidence that Iran participated in or helped plan the attack. That doesn't mean that it didn't. We just don't have the evidence to show it.
Secretary Blinken saying Iran never touched the money the U.S. unfroze, that Iranian oil money, transferred instead to Qatar in return for Iran releasing some U.S. prisoners. Now the U.S. and Qatar have again put a hold on that cash that was only earmarked for humanitarian aid. Hamas has called for a day of rage against Israelis and Jews Friday. This is ABC News. There is a verdict for two former Aurora, Colorado police officers tried for the 2019 death of a black man who died after he was stopped on his way home from the store.
Elijah McClain told the police officers in Aurora, Colorado, he could not breathe as he was held in a carotid hold and then injected unwillingly with a sedative ketamine. McClain then died. Now, Officer Randy Rodema found guilty of criminally negligent homicide and assault.
We had a jury find the defendant, Randy Rodema, guilty of assault in the third degree.
Another officer on scene was acquitted by the jury. Other officers and paramedics who were involved are next to go on trial. Officer Rodema will be sentenced in January. Alex Stone, ABC News.
Home loan rates are up again for the fifth straight week. Those mortgage rates climbed to 7.57%. It is the highest level in 23 years. Some good news for retirees. Social Security benefits go up 3.2% in January. Andy Field, ABC News.
Talk of Green Bay News, I'm Pete Schwaba. Here's what you need to know. The Manitowoc school superintendent is on the hot seat with some parents over the issue of free lunches. The conflict started when Superintendent James File decided to end the Free Lunch for All program. He made the decision himself to reinstate the school's pre-COVID policy. Many parents did not approve. They've since circulated a petition for File's resignation and have collected almost 600 names. File says not all students need free lunch and that some families can afford to pay, adding that freeing up those funds could help address other issues. Green Bay City workers want better pay. WBAY-TV reports that dozens of city workers attended a personnel committee meeting October 10th. City workers got wind of a proposed wage increase and say it's not high enough. A local alderman says the city is losing workers to other towns due to low wages. The issue will be further discussed at the next meeting in 2 weeks. Pete Schwaba, WGBW 97.9 News.
The Talk of Green Bay, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW programming is broadcast from the Bug Tussle Studios.
Bug Tussle, keeping you connected to the world around you.
Hi, we're the Goo Goo Dolls. We're fortunate that our daughters have what they need to grow and learn. But that isn't the case for nearly 13 million kids in the U.S. that struggle with hunger.
Childhood hunger is a heartbreaking reality that Feeding America is working to change. Each year, the Feeding America network of food banks rescues billions of pounds of good food that would have gone to waste and provides it to families and children in need.
You can help kids in need in your community by visiting feedingamerica.org.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
A no-holds-barred political conversation. That's Matt Flynn Direct.
Gerrymandering is not democracy, it's commie government. It's fake government. You have somebody that gets 48% of the vote and they get 67% of the seats. That is not democracy, it's fake democracy. It's the appearance of law without the reality or the actuality of law.
Matt Flynn Direct, weekday afternoons from 3 until 4 on the Civic Media Network and on the Civic Media app. As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry.
It's the Wild West of how students are using generative AI.
As educators, there's sort of six responses that we can have to these new tools. We could ignore it. Mm-hmm. We could ban it. We can try and outfox it. We can teach about it. We can actually teach it, or we can teach with it. I think the most exciting one, of course, is to teach with it.
As Goes Wisconsin with host Kristen Bry. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
My name is Teresa Barber. I was in the United States Navy, and I served overseas in the Middle East and Africa. Early on in my career, I had a commander that taught our suicide prevention training, and the very next day, he took his own life. 90% of suicide attempts involving a gun are fatal. My way of continuing my service is to help protect my community by being a responsible gun owner and by storing firearms safely. Store all your guns securely. Help stop suicide.
Brought to you by End Family Fire and the Ad Council.
As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry.
Well, he had a little chat with management yesterday, and I did suggest a daily limo and a fruit plate.
How did they take that?
That didn't seem to take that seriously for some reason.
I have full faith in you. You've been doing this for a long time. And you have Greg Bach.
I got a call from management this morning saying if I'd be interested in taking on new roles as a driver and buying fruit plates. That's a career opportunity.
Put that on your resume, baby.
Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
Planet-wide on the Facebooks, Mastodons, and site still known as Twitter, at Green News Report.
Are you tired of think tank-approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So as we've been talking about the last couple of days, some new reporting out, and nothing new. I mean, nothing surprising, but Reuters has got a new story out saying inequality is getting worse. It's gotten worse again. Thanks, pandemic. The rich are getting richer, the poor are getting poorer. But hey, the folks at the very bottom, because of the pandemic, because of all the labor organizing, they're doing a little bit better. They're doing a little bit better, but our top 1% still taking a larger share of the national wealth. As some believe it should be. Because we need to have a billionaire class, a benevolent billionaire class, who will eventually, fill their pockets and it'll trickle down. You've heard the story. And then we get to fight over what trickles out. I haven't found that trickle yet, but maybe I'm still hopeful, but here to share some thoughts on this latest reporting and maybe share some thoughts on how we actually create an economy that works for all. I've asked our good friend Morris Pearl to come talk with us. Morris is the chair of the Patriotic Millionaires, patrioticmillionaires.org, the website. If you want to take a look at the work that they do, Morris, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks, Rick. It's great to be in your show.
So what do you make of these latest numbers? You've got, the pandemic brought us, gilded age inequality. Our billionaire class, put a couple of trillion dollars extra wealth into their coffers at the expense of working people. Are we surprised, given the setup that we have, that this is our reality?
No, I'm not surprised, because the rich have been getting richer, and everyone else has been just having trouble getting by. And I think it's permanently been that way almost every year. And we've been working on this, I've been working on this for 10 years now, just Patriotic Millionaires, but people have been working on this for millennia and hundreds of years. And I think we've got this class of people who are sort of running the country, the politicians and business leaders, and they just feel that, well, workers are supposed to be poor. They're supposed to be dependent on their employers, who are supposed to be, I don't know, benevolent father figures or dictators or something. And it just makes me sick to think about that. I mean, I think people really believe that.
Yeah. No, I think we've been trained to think this way. I go back to the 90s and George Carlin, who I got to tell you, I miss George Carlin. especially in these moments, we could use someone like him. But he said back, you know, in the 90s, he said, look, you know, the rich have all the money. They pay none of the taxes. The middle class does all the work, pays all of the taxes. And the poor, they're there to scare the hell out of the middle class. So they keep showing up to those jobs and putting up with all of the guff that they get from the rich. And it's a very succinct comment. It's a very true comment if you look around.
Yes. I mean, I think that's what Trump was saying last week when he went to Michigan to speak, is that he was telling the workers, A, you should, the people actually work for a living, A, you should be worried about people with different color skin who can take your jobs, and B, you should be worried about your union leaders being too demanding and not having enough, not thinking about the plight of the poor company owners. And it's just absurd. This trickle-down thing, it's just not right.
You know, it's interesting you hit on the Trump comments, especially that part about you know, not getting too much out of the employer and caring about them. Because Trump was supposed to be the guy who was going to revive those jobs that supported a family. He was supposed to bring back the fabulous 50s and 60s. He was supposed to bring back all of those good union manufacturing jobs that supported a family on one income and did it very well, by the way. He was supposed to be that guy, and to have him say those things that did not get reported on very well is kind of remarkable.
It's just, I think he really believes it. You know, when he was running his real estate companies, he really believed that all of the workers sort of were like his, like, you know, I don't know, nephews or something that depended on him for their livelihood, the same way his children do. You know, this trickle-down thing, it just doesn't work. You know, look up the tapes when I was on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart just at the end of his reign. We were demonstrated that money doesn't trickle down. It trickles up.
Right.
Investors like me get rich every time people like you make your car payments and make your mortgage payments and make your iPhone payments and your phone bills and your electric bills. That money just in little bits from everybody's checks trickles up into the accounts of the people that own stock in all of those companies. And that's how people like me make money without having to work. Money doesn't trickle down. Money trickles up. I think that's what the American people have to understand.
No, I had a very wealthy uncle who used to, he wanted to educate me on wealth. And you know, he said, look, we could give all those poor people money. We could give all those poor people all the money. And eventually I would get it all. And I would go, yeah, I don't disagree with you. So how about we give people the ability to put food on their table, a roof over their head, and maybe, you know, the old ideal of bread, yes, but roses too. And yes, you'll get the money back. But in the process, we'll create decent lives for people. He didn't like that idea.
That's our whole point about raising wages. We've been advocating for higher minimum wage for years. Not because I'm altruistic and not because I think, oh my God, it's the poor people need this and that. I mean, it's true. It's very expensive and very hard to be poor. But really, we investors and business people need people who have enough money to pay for stuff and buy stuff. You know, I don't know if it's completely true about what Henry Ford said about needing to pay the workers so they have enough money to buy cars, but there's truth to that. We need to have workers making enough money to buy cars, or we won't be able to sell cars because there aren't enough rich people to buy very many.
No, you're absolutely right. And this is where, you know, my uncle was right. You know, look, he will, you know, the very wealthy, you and your Wall Street friends and the very wealthy, they are going to get all the money. We've seen that. We've seen it play out. But it would be nice if it went through us first.
Yes. It makes sense that way, but there's this whole mentality that, oh, workers are supposed to be like
in their place.
In their place, exactly.
Well, did you see the clip of the Australian CEO? I think his name was Tim Gurney. We played his clip here, you know, several times, where he said, look, we need like 40% higher unemployment. We need pain in the economy. We need those working people to know that they need us more than they need. They need us more than we need them. They need to know their place. Now, again, he took a little heat for it. He did, you know, some bit of a retraction afterwards. But the fact that it came out of his mouth so easily led me to go, look, this is what these folks say to each other when we're not around.
It's true. I was at a meeting with an official of the Biden administration, and they were going over their charts and things. They came up with something about the labor force participation is going up, meaning more people are looking for jobs, which is not a bad thing.
No.
And saying, oh, because there's more people joining the labor force, that will help keep wages down and prevent inflation. And I just stood up and said, are you really saying that? Is that really what you believe? And fortunately, they said, well, you're channeling what the same thing the President Biden said when he saw this. So, I mean, maybe the president is with us, but it's just ridiculous that people think that way. I remember a meeting I had with somebody about the Paycheck Protection Program. I said, hey, we need to, you know, send money to all these workers who lost their jobs because of the pandemic. This was early in the pandemic time.
Right.
I said, well, no, we need to send money to the employers because we need to maintain the connection of the employers and the workers. I'm like, really? That's our goal, is to make the workers have to be connected with their employers even after they've been laid off? That's the goal of your plan? And it just makes me sad to think that actually is what they meant. And
yeah, well, look, you know, both parties are the party of business. Some just, you know the Democratic Party has been the party of business as well, but just not to the extreme that Republicans have been. And you're going to have that kind of Larry Summers mentality on the Democratic side sometimes, which is why we need folks like you to be pushing both sides to be more, you know, more worker friendly, more citizen friendly.
We're working on it. We really are. We've got some Democrats who think our way, maybe not enough, and very few Republicans.
See, but I think this is where you're going to the voters, like you are doing with your Great Economy Project, is so important, where it's not about red hat or blue hat. And I say this all the time. It's not red hat, blue hat. It's hard hat. We've got a lot of work to do in this country, and it's, you know, no party's going to save us. We've got to save ourselves. But being educated on the issues that are important, the kitchen table stuff, of which you guys are doing very well, that's where we should be spending a lot of time, effort, and energy. And moving policy in that world to help create that prosperous working class that my grandparents' generation fought, bled, and died for.
We are getting voters together, or people together, and telling them about issues like how the tax policies work, why it is that I have a lower tax rate than anyone who works for a living, how it is that large company CEOs make so much more money than workers do. How it is that people sort of pretend to be philanthropists and stick their money aside and never actually use it for philanthropy. And, you know, five or six lessons, and the people are getting organized and they're calling their representatives, whether Democrats or Republicans, and asking them about these policies. Why aren't you for higher minimum wages? Why aren't you for taxing the rich? You know, we've done that in North Carolina. We've gone to Wisconsin. And now we're going to Pennsylvania, Western Pennsylvania next.
I look forward to that. You listen to The Rick Smith Show with Morris Pearl. Morris is the chairman of the Patriotic Millionaires. Check out the website, patrioticmillionaires.org. We'll get links out on social media, how you can do that. You know, in talking about taxes, I don't know if you saw this story about Microsoft, but the IRS is going to evidently going after Microsoft for some, what, $28 billion in back taxes. Any thoughts on going after corporate America to get them to fess up some of the stuff that they hoarded before the Jobs Act?
Well, they should. I mean, I don't know the specifics of Microsoft. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not commenting on their exact technical details. But basically, that's what they had in mind when they increased the budget of the IRS. That, and that the Republicans were all complaining about, oh, Biden wants to send, you know, guys in black suits to every small business in America. No, they were hiring lawyers to figure out what these big companies are doing and make them pay what they're supposed to be paying anyway. And of course, they want to cut the budget for that. That's how they want to save money.
Yeah.
Just makes me sick.
We got a lot of work to do, Morris, but I appreciate you taking a little time for us, sharing your expertise and your thoughts. Keep up the amazing work, and I look forward to having you back again real soon.
Great to be in your show. See you next week.
Thanks so much, our good friend Morris Pearl. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So it looks like not such great news for the SAG-AFTRA folks. They put out a Twitter press release saying that it's with profound disappointment that we report that the industry CEOs have walked away from the bargaining table after refusing to counter our latest offer. We have negotiated with them in good faith, despite the fact that last week they presented an offer that was shockingly worth less than they proposed before the strike began. They go on to say these companies refuse to protect performers from being replaced by AI. They refuse to increase your wages to keep up with inflation. And they refuse to share a tiny portion of the immense revenue your work generates for them. We have made big, meaningful counteroffers on our end, including completely transforming our revenue sharing proposal, which would cost the companies less than 57 cents per subscriber. They have rejected our proposals and refused to counter. Instead, they used bullying tactics. Just tonight, they intentionally misrepresented to the press the cost of the above proposal, overstating it by 60%. They have done the same with AI, claiming to protect performers' consent, but continuing to demand consent on the first day of employment for the use of a performer's digital replica for an entire cinematic universe or any franchise project. They go on to say the companies are using the same failed strategies they tried to inflict on the Writers Guild, putting out misleading information in an attempt to fool our members into abandoning our solidarity and putting pressure on our negotiators. But like the writers, our members are smarter than that, and we will not be fooled. And look, you know, this is what these companies do. They put out misinformation. They do this kind of, you know, not good faith bargaining because they want people desperate and hungry. And look, this strike's been going on a long time. These folks are struggling. And these people know it. So, of course, now is going to be the nitty-gritty. Now is the down and dirty. And you can't stop now. They have to continue to fight through this because the threat here is, you know, if they give in on the AI part, their jobs are gone. It's over. And, you know, I saw this thing today from Penn State's research group here in Pennsylvania that had the top 10 jobs in Pennsylvania that have a risk of being replaced by AI. And, you know, like billing and postal clerks, 100% chance of you losing your job if you're in those industries. If you're an office clerk, if you're a laborer or freight worker, if you stock shelves or move materials, 100% chance of being replaced. Bookkeeping, accounting, auditing clerks, 100% chance of being replaced. People who pack, packers and packagers, 100% chance of being replaced. Postal service mail carriers, 100% chance of being replaced. Fast food workers, fast food cooks, drivers and sales workers. You're looking at in the high 90s. Secretaries, administrative assistants, 94%. You're looking at high 90s of jobs being eliminated. Who's fighting for those jobs? And this is why I come back to this, the Screen Actors thing, why I come back to the Writers Guild. They're the front lines. They're the first battle in the war with AI. They're the first group saying, no, you're not going to take our jobs. No, you're not going to use our images. No, you're not going to, you're not going to steal from us. But what about all these other jobs? These are real people's livelihoods. And I know, well, go get retrained. There's no such thing as AI adjustment assistance. I mean, we don't have trade adjustment assistance anymore. The Republicans didn't re-up that. So if we lose jobs to trade, bad trade policy, you're out of luck. But we've got nothing like that with technology. So as AI comes online, you're just out of luck. There's no one to help. There's nothing here. And again, we've got a dysfunctional government. We've got a house where nothing is getting done. And guess who's happy about that? The very well-to-do. You know who keeps writing Republicans checks? The rich people. Because they love dysfunctional government. They love broken government. Corporate America loves broken government. You know why? Because the only person who can restrain, the only entity that can restrain corporate excess, the only entity that can go after the billionaire class and hold them in check is our government. A government of, for, and by we the people, us. And while we've out-procreated the moneyed interest, they've got all the money. So a shutdown, chaos, a broken nature, a broken house works for them. Status quo works for them. They got their hands planted firmly on the steering wheel. 10-2. Or is it 9-3 now? When I was a kid, it was 10-2. Last I checked, it was, I think the kids told me it was 9-3. Not high noon with your wrist hanging over. But this is what the wealth class is thrilled with. It's broken. Nobody's accountable. It's the Wild West for corporate America. Just the way they want it. And every day we do nothing. Every day we allow to pass without us trying to get ahead of what is coming, we're falling farther and farther behind. So all the jobs that are going to be lost, and understand, I think it was 5 or 6 years ago, they said in 20 years, half the jobs we do now will be gone. So think of half of the jobs that are being done right now just being gone in the next 15 years. I expect the job that I do, working in the freight industry, at some point before I retire, to be automated. And before I die, to be gone. Because the technology's already there. What are all of those people going to do? What are all the working people who rely on these jobs going to do? And when you've got, and as Morris pointed out, what you've got is you've got, people like Trump going, well, you shouldn't ask for too much because you might encourage them to go faster. Look, they're steaming toward mechanization, AI, robotics, however you want to put it. They're steaming towards that as fast as they can. You asking for a little bit more is not gonna make that go any faster. The second they can replace working people, the second they can get a machine to churn out 24/7, 365 with no health care, no pension, no workers' comp, no unemployment, no any, they're going. And you have to ask yourself, what does that mean for our entire system of not just government, but our retirement system, our healthcare systems, our Social Security, our Medicare, our societal systems, the tax base for local and state and federal? What does that mean? Because we're certainly not taxing the rich in corporate America who are going to be the ones who are going to be reaping all the benefits. No, not doing that. And I know, you know, if we do, but Rick, if we tax the rich, they'll leave. Let them. Just not taking the money with them. But I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. Are you in an industry where you're concerned about robotics, AI, the end of your career? I want to hear about it. Email me, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1845. That was the day that the first Industrial Congress of the United States met in New York City. People interested in the problems facing working people, including long hours, low pay, and unsafe working conditions, gathered together. The labor movement was just beginning in this country. These were the years when the early trade unions were formed. Women played an important role in the early labor movement. Female textile mill workers in Lawrence, Massachusetts, began to organize for the 10-hour day. In 1844, they established the Lowell Female Labor Reform Association. Their goal was to improve working conditions in the mills. The Lowell Women's Group sent a representative to New York for the Labor Congress. Another important development of the fledgling labor movement was the establishment of labor presses. George Henry Evans, a labor newsman, also attended the Congress. He was the editor of a series of U.S. labor papers, starting with the Workman's Advocate in 1829. He had come to the United States from England, where he had been involved in the trade labor movement. He also attended the Labor Congress. The meeting recommended the formation of three organizations. First was an industrial brotherhood for workers, including farmers. The second was an industrial sisterhood for women workers. The third was a group for friends of labor. The Congress met again in New York in 1847, then again met in Chicago in 1850. These early efforts to establish larger labor groups did not gain much traction, but they began to lay the framework for workers to come together to discuss their challenges and imagine how they could work together to bring about change for better wages, shorter hours, and safer working conditions. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Over time, words with beautiful meanings occasionally get degraded into ugliness. Gentle, for example. Originally meaning good-natured and kindly, it was twisted into gentry in the Middle Ages by very ungentle land barons seeking a patina of refinement. Then it became a pretentious verb to gentrify, meaning to make something common appear upscale. And now the word has devolved to gentrification, describing the greed of developers and speculators who oust middle and low-income families from their communities to create trendy enclaves for the rich. The latest move by these profiteers is their meanest yet, targeting families with the most tenuous hold on affordable shelter, people living in mobile home parks. Some 20 million Americans, especially vulnerable senior citizens, veterans, the disabled, and immigrant workers, make their homes in these inexpensive parks. Well, inexpensive until the vultures sweep in, including multi-billion-dollar Wall Street powerhouses like Blackstone Group, Apollo Global Management, and Carlyle Group that are buying up hundreds of trailer parks across the country. These are easy for unprincipled speculators to grab. While tenants might own their mobile homes, they rent the lots, and the first sign that a huckster has taken over a neighborhood park is an unwarranted spike in everyone's rent. Residents are captive tenants, for these homes are not really mobile, and even if one can be moved, the cost can top $10,000. New Yorker magazine notes that today's typical mobile home park has been called a waffle house where customers are chained to their booths. Corporate predators are steadily driving out lower-income families, then remaking the parks to attract upscale owners of million-dollar mobile homes. This is Jim Hightower saying, and where do former tenants go? Away, out of sight, out of mind.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, an interesting question. You know, you look at what's going on in the House, the chaos that is the Republican Party at this moment. And you know, the question, why? Does anyone know why? You know, is this just a matter of, you know, the button was there, so you know, we pushed it. You know, it's just, hey, you know, I saw it, you know. Yeah, sure, the oven was hot, but I wanted to see what would happen. So I wanted to see what happened. Here to help maybe walk through on why this is happening, how this, I guess the how is, well, easy. The why, that's a little harder. That's why I've asked Bill Scheer to come talk with us. Bill is the politics editor over at the Washington Monthly. You can check out his stuff over at BillScheer.com. Bill, thanks for taking time for us.
Always a pleasure.
So why, Bill? Why are we here?
I wish I like to bring you answers, Rick. That is what I feel I'm from this earth to do. I have no answers for you. I think there is no obvious why. No one's articulating a why. I mean, I understood what the substantive complaint was with Kevin McCarthy.
Right.
At least from the vantage point of the Matt Gaetzes of the Republican conference. They wanted a shutdown. They wanted deeper spending cuts and also some possible policy riders like the border, for example. And they were unhappy that McCarthy, who had already abandoned what the Renegades wanted back in January, which was a literal balanced budget over a 10-year period, which sort of sounds nice, but it actually involves very draconian cuts. McCarthy, being sane, realized I can't avoid a debt default or keep the government open with that position. So he abandoned it right away, did a deal with Joe Biden in the spring, set spending caps on a bipartisan basis, avoided a debt default. And the people who weren't thrilled with McCarthy in the first place never wanted to accept, didn't want to accept that, and kept pushing him for deeper and deeper cuts. And McCarthy played along for a time, and then when they hit the midnight hour and you had to keep the government open, McCarthy said, I'm not going to shut down the government over this. Kept it open. And that's when the guillotine came down. It's like that I understood. I understood why. Now, they're not even debating what the spending levels are or should we keep the government open or anything else for that matter. It just seems to be chaos for chaos' sake. At some point, it's just going to make Republicans look like they're not capable of being a governing party.
Well, I argue they're not. And what I've been saying is, look, they're telling us they don't want to be in the majority. They want to be the minority bomb throwers. They want to be the ones who are yelling and screaming and pointing. Look how bad they are. They don't have an agenda. They don't have any policy ideas. They just want to be the chaos merchants. And this is what they're telling us. They're telling us they want Democrats to be in charge.
Well, to be a little charitable here, remember, it was only 8 Republicans that wanted to shift McCarthy. Most of them wanted to keep him around. Most of them voted for the bill to keep the government open. Most of them voted for the debt limit deal with Joe Biden. I mean, it was more than 8 who opposed those bills, but even the people who opposed the bill said, you know what, I'm still going to keep McCarthy. I don't want total chaos. It was only 8. And now it just seems like it's unleashed. I mean, it's a high school, you know, it's a high school mean girls deal right now where both camps are mad at each other for the situation they've been put in. And it just seems like it's now a set of overlapping grudges that's making it impossible to get to a consensus choice for speaker.
Yeah. So Scalise is out. Actually, you know, came in, had a couple more votes and I guess lost votes as the day went on. Never got to the 150 he thought he had. Who's next? I mean, you know, does Jordan, you know, since he, you know, bowed out, does he pop back up? Does McCarthy pop back in?
I mean, there are definitely people out there pushing Jordan and McCarthy. Again, it's hard to play mind reader. You know, all I can do, you know, as a political analyst is try to assess rational, logical incentives for action.
And are there any of those here?
Well, this is such much more a personality fight now than a policy fight or an ideological fight. So it's harder to assess from the outside. I would think it would be difficult to get consensus around Jordan because Jordan had fewer votes than Scalise in the first place.
Right.
So the people were for Scalise to have to now fold and give it to the guy who came in number two because enough of the Jordan voters were too petulant to accept who the winner was. I would think that'd be too big a pill to swallow for those who are in the Scalise majority. It's still possible they could be like, this is so insane that we don't have a speaker. I don't want to be in a situation where we can't pass a bill to help Israel, where we can't pass a bill to keep the government open. So maybe I have to swallow that pill and give it to Jordan. But I would think they'd have a lot of reason and cause to say, screw you guys, it's going to be somebody else. You don't get to be terrorists within this body and get your way every single time, even when you lose. So that's my gut feeling. But again, it's really hard to read from the outside.
Yeah, because we're in uncharted water here. I mean, the fact that they can't get into a room and figure this out, because this looks bad for them, doesn't it?
Look, I mean, it does look bad for them. I do worry that at some point it splatters on Democrats. And this is I was a rare voice counseling Democrats to keep McCarthy in the first place, precisely because I was worried about the level of chaos this could unleash. I mean, chaos in general makes, if Republicans are in disarray, it makes Republicans look bad. If Republicans instigate a shutdown, it makes Republicans look bad. The instigating party always takes the heat when they push a shutdown. We've seen that multiple times over the past several decades. However, if you're in government shutdown for months and months, at some point, you'll start to take a bite out of GDP. And if the economy is going south in an election year, you know, Joe Biden can say all day long, well, don't blame me, it's these idiots that couldn't keep the House open. At some point, the voter says, well, you told me, Joe Biden, you're going to make things normal again. So why haven't you figured that out? So that's what I worry about. This gets so bad that ends up splattering on Joe Biden.
Yeah, but come on. What am I thinking? Of course we don't know how government works. Of course we're going to blame Joe Biden for this, because he's going to blame him for everything else. Why not? Absolutely.
Well, this was always the Democratic fear has long been that Republicans would behave in a nihilistic way, burn it all down, make everything dysfunctional on purpose, just so they could blame it on the Democratic president. That was the fear in the Obama administration. It was the fear when Biden came in now. And what has been refreshing, what had been refreshing over the past few years, is that Mitch McConnell didn't play that in the first few years. He did not do government shutdowns. He helped pass bipartisan bills like the infrastructure bill, the semiconductor bill, the gun safety bill. And here's Kevin McCarthy, who was more tethered to a more unruly caucus, and even he was able to avert a debt default. So that's why my attitude was, hey, this is as good as it's going to get, Democrats, considering the lot of Republicans you have to deal with. So don't play with fire, but here we are playing with fire.
No, I mean, this is crazy, because here we're, what, 30 days away from potentially another shutdown. You've got the president going to be asking for funding for Israel and Ukraine, and I don't know who you're going to ask for it, because there's nobody functional in the House to emanate, you know, the bill. We got real problems.
Yeah, and I think it was in the Democratic interest to show they could keep that they could end chaos, and they could bring back a veneer of stability and functionality. I mean, we keep talking about how dysfunctional things was. As far as I'm concerned, over the past 2.5 years, these are pretty gosh darn functional, considering what's going on in the rest of society. And I hope we can get back there. I hope that whoever becomes speaker will have enough sense to recognize that you have to keep a government open, you have to deal with international crises. I think McConnell and McCarthy made the calculation, sure, maybe we can burn all down and Joe Biden can go up in flames, but it's still a massive risk to us if we're doing this on purpose, that we can't, over the long haul, be seen as a responsible party to trust with the keys. So whether it's Jordan or whoever pops up right now, I mean, Jordan was trying to make outreach to the Republican moderates, as moderate, using that term loosely, trying to indicate they wouldn't burn everything down. If you're going to be speaker, you're applying for a job that requires adult supervision. That your job is to be the adult. If you don't want that job, don't run for the position. You know, people like Matt Gaetz literally says, "I don't want to be speaker. I want to make it impossible for other people to be speaker. But I don't want to be speaker myself." He's not an adult.
Yeah,
he is a petulant child. Don't let the petulant child run the show. Someone's got to be the grown up here.
Is there anyone who's palatable to Democrats then? I mean, you know,
Democrats would take anybody. Democrats might have been harboring this notion that they could pull off a bipartisan speaker triple axle. And hey, maybe the gamble will pay off. You know, I don't want to say it's like totally impossible, but I mean, maybe the Matt Gaetzes of the world will be so. I mean, and even Gaetz is even the biggest problem right now. Gaetz said he would have voted for Scalise. You know, it's Lauren Boebert and the Bob Goods who made this impossible. Nancy Mace, who makes no rhyme or reason to me. But Democrats have been saying we'll work with Republicans on a speaker, but they have to pledge that they will put certain bills on the floor, that they give us more people on committees. I mean, these are the things that have been sort of floated in the press. And if you're asking for like that much, it becomes politically toxic for a Republican to cross that line. I mean, even a Don Bacon, who, I mean, there's a good number of Biden district Republicans like Don Bacon, who reps Omaha, Nebraska. It's a blue dot in Nebraska. Or Mike Lawler, who is upstate New York. That's a Biden plus 10 district. They make noise about being bipartisan at times, but they still have to win Republican primaries. So to go outright in open, you know, embrace of a Democratic plan to run the House, you know, that's going to be a bridge too far. That's why my attitude was, if they can keep the government open, that's as good as you're going to get, Democrats, right now. They're not going to pass the immigration bill you want right now. That's not what this group is going to do. But they can keep the government open, maybe. And if there's that kind of agreement, that bare minimum, maybe you can do a bipartisan deal. But beyond that, I think it's asking too much.
Well, maybe that's coming, and maybe you let this play out for a couple more days. Because look, I got to tell you, if I'm the Democrats, I'm sitting back and I'm letting them show who they are.
I mean, we are where we are now. I mean, at this point, you know, that's the best Democrats can hope for, is that the chaos will become so insane that Republicans take all of the heat for it. But it certainly is helpful for Hakeem Jeffries to be offering escape hatches. Like, hey, America, hey, House Republicans, I would like to make this normal again. Here's my plan to do so. I just don't think you should put too high, make the price tag too big on it.
Yeah, well, we'll see. We'll see where this goes. I'm hopeful that we have functional government again, because we need it. But I'm not optimistic.
I'm less optimistic today than I was a couple weeks ago.
Scary, scary stuff. But Bill, I appreciate your thoughts as always. Good stuff, man.
Great to talk to you. Take care.
Our good friend Bill Scheer. Make sure you check out the work that he does over at the Washington Monthly, where he's the politics editor. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at his work. Also, check out BillScheer.com. I'm going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. Bury me with my boys in Mount Olive, and let no traitor draw breath over my grave. Such was the last wish of labor leader Mother Jones. She wanted her final resting place to be alongside the coal miners who gave their lives in the struggle to bring fair wages and a safe working environment to Verdun, Illinois. And on this day in labor history, the year was 1898. Members of the newly formed United Mine Workers of America were out on strike against the Chicago Verdun Coal Company mine. They demanded the company pay the new mining wage scale of 40 cents per ton of coal mined. The company refused. Worried that management would try to sneak in replacement workers, the striking men patrolled the railroad tracks leading to the mine. Both black and white strikers joined the lookout parties. Just a little after noon on that fateful day, the men spotted a train coming toward them. It was loaded with strikebreakers, African-American workers recruited from Alabama. Looking to escape the oppression of the South, the black workers had not been told about the labor unrest in Verdun. Many refused to work for the company once they learned the truth. The train was also packed with armed guards hired by the company. Determined not to let the replacement workers through, armed strikers met the train at the depot. A gun battle ensued. 8 miners were killed. 4 armed guards also died. A month later, the union won its wage demands. 3 of the union miners who lost their lives that day were laid to rest at the Mount Olive Union Miners Cemetery. It was these men who Mother Jones loved as her boys.
New dirt falling on a new made coffin. New dirt falling on a new made coffin. I'm way over in that union.
Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com. Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So I came across this story about Mary Lou Retton. Evidently, Mary Lou's not doing well. She has some kind of pneumonia, evidently in a coma. And evidently, the way this story has been reported, her daughter has raised something like $300,000 in crowdfunding to pay her medical expenses. Evidently, according to the crowdfunding, Mary Lou is fighting for her life in the battle with pneumonia. A business person gave her $50,000. But the other $250,000 came from, just average everyday working steps. And I got to tell you, this is someone who lives in a massive mansion, is worth a couple million dollars, has means. This is not a poor person by any stretch. This is not somebody who fell on hard times. This is not someone who is destitute. This is not someone who, I didn't have health insurance. No, this is someone who chose not to have health insurance, made a conscious decision not to insure herself. This is what I'm getting. Now, evidently, according to reports, has some kind of pre-existing condition. But guess what? The Affordable Care Act did away with that. Now, remember, this is someone who lobbied and did a whole bunch of media around how bad the ACA was. This is somebody who was anti-ACA. And now she's got a serious healthcare condition, evidently not able to breathe on her own, and doesn't have health insurance. And guess what? Shock of all shockers, healthcare is expensive. Now, the report says nobody knows why she doesn't have health insurance. But what we do know is she did campaign against the ACA. She was opposed to the COVID vaccine. So the fact that she's got pneumonia, could it be COVID related? Who knows? But again, this is another one of these moments where I'm quite angered by the fact that someone made a choice, and now you're going to the goodness of hardworking people to bail them out. And I know, Rick, you're being mean. Rick, you're being unforgiving. Yeah. Okay, fine. This is one of those things that I can't help but think of the people who donated to this crowdsource. You know, good, decent, honest, hardworking people, salt of the earth people, who, you know, who knows, may have given their last $5 for all I know, because our national treasure is in a moment of need. People from her hometown of Fairmont, West Virginia, which is a poor coal mining town, full of struggling people who I lived there for a year. I met these folks. In fact, played baseball with her brother. I think about them and the fact that, you know, they probably don't have health insurance. They can't afford to get sick. And yet they're sending money to someone who could. Someone who could have insured themselves. Someone who could have had the personal responsibility to care for themselves, but didn't. I got to tell you, there's a lot of thoughts here. A lot of thoughts. One, you know, no one should have to fundraise because they got sick. No one should go broke or bankrupt because they got sick. No one should go without health insurance. And I was a firm believer in the ACA's mandate. And you know what? Here's the really weird part. That mandate, that personal responsibility mandate, that was put in because of Republicans. Because if you remember, Republicans used to be, the party of personal responsibility. They used to believe that you should be responsible for yourself. In fact, the mandate was kind of their idea, that everybody had to be in. Couldn't have free riders. Couldn't have people gaming the system. That is, until a Democrat proposed it and put it into law. Then it became, look at what they did to you. And this is this weird world that we're in, where one side does something reflexively, the other side has to be against it. Because we have to choose our teams, we got to find our sides, got to get on our sidewalk, so that we can throw things at each other. That, I got to tell you, is just plain insane. But it's where we are. It's a world that sadly we live in. And here we are in this moment where, guess what? This woman is probably dying. You know, and I would not be surprised if it's COVID related. Wouldn't be surprised at all. Let's finish up with a little bit more crazy. This Candace Keller, former Ohio legislator, evidently she is tickled pink, thrilled that there is a war in Israel. Put on Facebook that, you can't make this up. Quote, I'm pretty excited. We're all going home. Yeah. This is the evangelical point of view. There's a war in Israel. Oh, boy. Rapture. The rapture is coming. The end times. Yeah, this is her. She's also the one who was complaining that, you know, liberals, whenever there's a mass shooting and, you know, kids get killed in schools, you know, they don't ever talk about fatherless homes. No, no. They don't talk about those transgenders, no. They don't talk about homosexual marriage, no. They just talk about guns. Yeah, because guns, guns. I know guns don't kill people. People kill people. But the gun helps. And sadly, with the guns that we have today that we didn't have 30, 40, 50 years ago, helps a lot more. So when crazy people start posting crazy things like this, I'm excited. We're all going home. I tell her, you know, why do we have to have a war? Can't you just leave now? We could do without you. We could get by.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay. WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.